Coming up with This Week in Computer Hardware, NVIDIA GTX gets ray tracing drivers, WPA3 cracked and patched, Elgato's Camlink 4K SSD picks, and yes, your Android phone is now a security key. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 512, recorded on April 11th, 2019. NVIDIA brings ray tracing to the masses. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Smart Deploy. Smart Deploy allows IT departments to reimage unlimited computer models from one golden image. Search their library for your models and get 15 free licenses with 1 year of support. That's $720 worth of free IT software at smartdeploy.com/twitch. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch Weekly Show that aims to bring you shock hardware news, desktops, consoles, mobile, the Internet of Stuff, which just sits there baiting us with its automated hair dryers and its internet trackable spoons. I'd be joking, except that at least one of those things actually legitimately exists. Right now, though, let's talk about hardware, the future of gaming, and bring on Mr. Sebastian Peake, co-host at large, Michigander at heart, and editor-in-chief of PCPer.com.
Sir. And you forgot to mention, totally surrounded by hardware, like all totally. Around me, off camera, in front of me, on every shelf, hardware.
I'm in this room.
Has been reviewed or is waiting for a review.
Yeah, there's now two sets of speakers, an amplifier, three desktops, four Elgato capture cards, a partridge, and a pear tree, all in the process of being reviewed or built in my primary working space, which is why I'm here with knowledge and literature behind me. But we were going to be on topic and not talk about black hole photos, which are awesome. Yay, science! NVIDIA released the ray tracing driver for the GeForce GTX. I'm feeling a little cynical about this one, that it's a desperate plea for developers to include RTX ray tracing in a larger pool of games, because we've seen what dedicated performance essentially drops precipitously, or at least a lot, to use highly scientific terms, in honor of our science black hole show today. When you use ray tracing in games on the RTX cards, kind of out of the blue, NVIDIA decided or announced that they were going to bring GTX cards into the fold with a ray tracing driver. And there are some ray tracing demos. Is this going to be usable at anything below the 1080 Ti level? Or can I, is it time for me to sort of pair up a couple of 1070s? Is this just kind of, hey, developers, some of you, please, more games, please? Or is this actually something where if I have like a GTX 1060 or 1070, it's going to be a usable experience?
Well, I haven't done testing. It's just this driver dropped this morning. We were only briefed about this.
Had several hours.
I've had several hours, I know. The one thing that I took away from this, and I have been in favor of them enabling these features on the Pascal cards, the 10 series cards, so your GTX cards from like the last 2 years, which when the RTX series was released last year, it was introducing the ability to perform real-time ray tracing for the first time in a consumer card. This is something that, you've seen real-time ray tracing if you've seen certain demos in the past, or if you've gone and seen like any movie made by Pixar, that kind of realistic lighting, the thing that transforms it from looking cartoonish to looking more real. That comes from rendering rays of light, and it's an extremely compute-intensive process. And so the Turing architecture of these RTX 20 series cards has dedicated ray tracing cores, which do nothing else. And while graphics cards, in the modern history of GPUs, have had programmable shader cores, so you could potentially tell the shader core to do any sort of work, not just fixed math, you could theoretically, from the very beginning, have said, well, 10 series, the Pascal cards, all the existing cards from like the last 2 years can have these features. They just won't be very effective at it under a certain performance threshold. And clearly the selling point of the 20 series was the ray tracing capabilities. It's RT, Ray Tracing X. It's not GTX. They're GeForce brand for many years. So with this change that we heard about at GDC or GTC, NVIDIA's graphics technology event, it makes sense to use the most powerful graphics card you have at your disposal. But what was cool to me about this is not just the announcement of the driver we were expecting, because we heard about this previously, was that simultaneously they're releasing these demos. So you can just download these demos, just like in the old days where you have new graphics features that the latest cards support, and you have these demos you can download. And if you can get the demo to run, you can see really cool effects that might motivate you to upgrade your hardware, like chasing higher frames per second because, wow, it's like the coolest thing I've ever seen on my computer screen. And I think, like, you're skeptical, and I am too, to an extent, but at the same time, this to me is how it should have been from the beginning. I editorialized a little bit in my post about this today, where I basically said that if you look back at the early days of dedicated accelerators,
right,
demos have been kind of an integral part of the whole thing, where you don't have to pay anything. You just see what your existing hardware can do, and it might motivate you to upgrade. It was not compelling to be told to buy an expensive graphics card and then wait for software to support the features.
But the chicken, the egg. You should pay for the chicken. Eventually the eggs will come. That's not a...
Right, not everyone is a farmer or can keep chickens. You know, there are limits depending on where you live, Patrick. There's zoning laws. I don't even know if I can have chickens if I wanted to.
Once again, Sebastian demonstrates why I try to avoid using metaphor or similes around him. You know, I was merely trying to suggest that NVIDIA was hoping we would all trust them to deliver. You know,
NVIDIA doesn't develop games, so they can release the graphics cards all they want to. I think it was last October we saw them first, but at that point we just had the promise of games to support the technology available with these cards, and a significant portion of these GPUs was devoted to, like, on the actual die, was devoted to the performance of software capabilities that were not being integrated into games.
Yet.
Is a very long-winded way of saying that, I guess.
No, but I agree. I mean, we certainly talked about this, and it was a bizarre release, right? Because it's, we have the future of gaming. Ray tracing, that delicious rendering we all know from the most up-to-date, fantastic Hollywood cinematic features, is going to be available for every gamer with a PCI slot. You know what I mean? It was like that weird kind of breathy introduction, and there was some video, and there was the card's going to be available, and eventually the games, you know. And then Battlefield 5 came out, and the benchmarks were atrocious in terms of the frame rates. And then, like, a month later, they optimized the driver, and the frame rates were not as atrocious and were fairly acceptable. It's been a peculiar launch cycle. I don't know how else to describe it. It's been a peculiar launch cycle, and their obsession with RTX, which is now, you know, maybe their desire to advance, you know, the quality of graphics for the industry, which is actually a noble goal. I think it's a fairly long game, and it's opened up an opportunity, one we will know much more about on the 1st of July or you know, early in, you know, late in June when we see AMD's next generation cards. It feels like a door has been opened for AMD to catch up for the vast majority of gaming platforms and then to worry about ray tracing rendering after the market either emerges or evolves or does not. Lucky them.
And to your point, because what NVIDIA is doing with this driver release is just taking advantage of the shader cores that are already there and assigning some of those shaders the job of doing the real-time ray tracing. And AMD could do the very same thing if they had the time, if they had the resources to devote to implementing it with their drivers they could say the next generation of cards also supports ray tracing. It's just AMD's version. So, because the when you're talking about software, one of the things that came out during the game developers conference was so many more titles, so many more game engines, at least at first, and titles to come will be supporting DXR features. And this is stuff that's going to be part of DirectX. And there's even, like, we saw one of the game engines, it was, I forget the engine at this moment, but it was taking advantage of the Vulkan API and running real-time ray tracing. So I think that was CryEngine. So it's not even necessarily API dependent, and it is not hardware dependent. So it's gone from, we saw back in October, NVIDIA cornering this admittedly very small market and saying, we have the only hardware on the market that can do this in real time, to then seeing a Vega 56 perform a real-time ray tracing of the Neon Noir demo that CryEngine had. So it's gone to kind of the software level. And whether these cards, and it starts with the GTX 1660, that $219 card in the new Touring GTX series, and goes back all the way to the GTX 1060 6GB. So if you have basically any Pascal card starting with that 1060 up through the 1080 Ti or either of the two new GTX cards from this year, you can enable this. And when they were showing slides kind of warning of how the performance won't be as good as with an RTX card, Battlefield 5 was one of the examples on stage. And I'm looking at the chart here. The performance disparity between a GTX 1080 Ti and an RTX 2080 is 1.6x, according to them. And that includes the extra performance boost of DLSS. So really, the difference between a 2080 and a 1080 Ti in this game, anyway, is only about, you know, 1x. So you're getting between, it looks like, about 40, 45 frames a second with the 1080 Ti. And then you get to about the 60 frame per second mark with the 2080. So it's definitely playable with the older hardware. Gives you a taste for it. Maybe good enough, depending on the settings that you choose, the resolution you choose to play. Right. But I would much rather the consumer have that choice. Enable this feature. Check it out at home. If they don't notice any difference between ray tracing on and ray tracing off in their game, then obviously they have no reason to upgrade their card. So
if they do, it's going to be interesting.
Hey.
If they do, it's great. It'll be interesting to watch this evolve. I'm really curious, right? Because it's a couple of 3 weeks ago that we saw the Unreal Engine running a ray tracing demo, and I think that's kind of the exciting stuff looking forward, as you were mentioning. We wait with bated breath. I want to be more excited about RTX than I am right now. I think it's kind of my takeaway on this one. It's been interesting to watch as we're starting to see next generation Wi-Fi technology, evolve this year. And we'll have more to talk about on that when there are actual clients to work with some of the routers that are doing 802.11ax or Wi-Fi 6, I guess I should say. But one of the crazy things is Wi-Fi protected access 2. They finally announced WPA 3, the replacement. And literally yesterday, it was announced that there were vulnerabilities inside the WPA 3 standard. Not necessarily, because as soon as you see it, of course, you think like WPA 3 can be cracked and they'll read all of my packets or they'll be able to get into my network. But this was an interesting collection of like side channel leaks and it was like a couple of side channel attacks, and if you were attached to multiple networks, a way to sort of hack the way into the network. The end result of this, though, that I thought was kind of exciting was that the Wi-Fi Alliance announced literally the same day that they had patches in place, software patches in place, to correct the vulnerabilities in the, in the security that has practically not even been released yet, WPA 3 personal. So one, yay security researchers, and two, yay Wi-Fi Alliance for working quickly and efficiently to A, mitigate these, and B, mitigate them kind of openly and honestly, which I appreciate. I think they were a little, you know, there's like the sort of third line of the press release on the security update. WPA3 Personal is in the early stages of deployment, and the small number of device manufacturers that are affected have already started deploying patches to resolve the issues. Yeah. And then they very clearly state, these issues can all be mitigated through software updates without any impact on devices' ability to work well together. There is no evidence that these vulnerabilities have been exploited, which makes sense because basically no one fundamentally has WPA3.
Yeah, it does make it a little bit easier for them, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, so, but, you know, on the upside, they're not denying it. They're not hiding it. You know, I don't think any members of the Wi-Fi Alliance have shorted their or sold off their stock before the information becomes public. Intel. Props to them for being on top of that. And let's hope that security researchers keep hammering on it to make sure it is robust as possible before, of course, it reaches broad deployment. So, Intel Optane memory update. Memory H10 with a solid state storage coming to a laptop near you. This is interesting, right? Because you've got Optane memory, an Intel QLC NAND on a single M2 device. Is this going to be for end users? Is this for manufacturers? And is this going to deliver ridiculous performance?
I think at this point, I know for sure it's for OEMs only. They specifically stated that. This is not a device you're going to go out and buy for yourself. And it's also targeting small form factor. So, of course, laptop, and then they said some all-in-one or mini PCs, just anywhere where it's kind of like space and thermally constrained. It's, as far as performance goes, it's interesting because the way that Optane memory works, there's already, you know, existing implementation of this on desktop where you could get an Optane memory device. You can pair it up with storage. The software takes care of turning Optane into basically a cache. And as you use it, real-world performance improves for you, responsiveness performs for you, or improves for you. So it's going to be a little tricky to benchmark this once we actually have this in hand and can start testing it out. They said laptops equipped with this are going to start showing up in Q2. So we'll have a chance to look at it then. But it definitely has the potential to make everyday computing faster. This is not going to look amazing on a benchmark, I don't think,
right?
Because at some point you're just going to be testing either the Optane or you're going to be testing the NAND. And this is basically being paired with, you know, moderately performant SSDs. So like QLC is not like earth shattering in the performance, especially not with this implementation. It'll be acceptably fast, I'm sure, but then provide some interesting data points as we look at, well, what happens the second time you open this application as it sort of intelligently decides what to cache. And
you mean the stuff I have a lot kind of already does in main system memory if you give it enough main system memory? It feels like,
yeah,
you know, on one level, anything that makes inexpensive systems feel faster or perform faster, I'm down with. But, you know, one, I mean, I was surprised it was like, you know, 16 gigabytes of Optane memory, 32 gigabytes of Optane memory. And while I believe Optane is more efficient than putting memory on the cache or cache memory on the hard drive, I'm like, you know, I've got, you know, hard drives with 256 gigabytes of cache on them. So, and those are standard rotating hard drives. Those are Reds. It's not exactly apples to apples. It's more apples to pears or apples to, you know, kumquats. But, you know, it seems like in many ways Optane really needed to be much less expensive and come out like a year before it did in volume. Maybe memory prices are going to tick up and this is going to seem fantastic.
That's one of those things where by going this OEM route, they kind of eliminate that. Like the consumer is not going to see the price sheet that the OEM is paying for these in whatever massive quantities they order. So this is probably going to end up being a more affordable way to get into Optane, especially when you're like, you think about a laptop where the ultra thin and light designs might only have space for one like M.2 stick. And, you know, this is something that I would not be, I'm not sure if I would, Apple would probably have their own proprietary way of implementing something like this. This is, we've only heard like the usual suspects when it comes to OEMs. It was Dell, HP, and Asus to start with. And speaking of Apple, they've had something similar to this, but of course using hard drive mixed with SSD, their Fusion Drive, which they introduced a few years ago now, which kind of changed some people's minds, I know, in this industry about how effective caching could be, because we'd already looked at caching where there were the hybrid hard drives that had come out, and there was a certain amount of SSD space, and the benchmarks never looked that good in reviews because you eventually hit the limitations of the spinning media. Response time was a little bit better, but it was subject to different factors. So that's one of those, looking this over, it strikes me that it will be a little harder on reviewers to come up with like the full story. Like, how does this actually feel? Because so much of what reviewers do are based on like synthetic benchmark numbers, and that won't really tell the story. So it's like, if you have this laptop and it really feels snappy and it's doing everything you want it to do, then that's great. And if you don't even notice the added cost because you just go out and buy a laptop at Best Buy and it comes with this and you're looking at the specs and it says like it has a terabyte of storage, but it also has this fast cache. We've seen the effectiveness of portions of SSDs that are allotted to just run in like SLC mode, that one bit mode. And that makes a huge difference. And you see a big drop off once you run out of that SLC cache in these like longer benchmark runs. So for really quick access for those low queue depth, random reads and writes, I will be very interested to see if this does make a big difference, especially like you'd mentioned having a lot of memory. Well, there's another example of how often you are somewhat memory constrained with a laptop. My everyday laptop, I think, has 8 gigabytes. Most laptops ship with around 8. You can get 16. Sometimes that's one of those like configuration options you have to order at the time because so few ultra thin laptops anyway come with removable memory DIMMs anymore. So it's kind of interesting to see how it'll be integrated because this is an OEM thing, at least as of right now.
I don't know. It's one of those things where it's physically testing. It's going to be more, I think, traumatic or intriguing than actually using it, because it's either going to work or it's not. And you'd have to have two identically configured systems, one with the Optane memory, one without the Optane memory, ideally. Because it would also be hysterical if they're like, well, here's a rotating media laptop, and here's one with Optane memory in an SSD. And it's like, I don't know. We'll see what happens when people actually start shipping it. In cheerful news, I'm going to pull up really quickly Amazon.com, looking at like Samsung 860 Evos, just for fun. 500 gigabytes, $78. Now, these are 2.5-inch, not M.2 drives. These are not NVMe drives, but 1 terabyte drives, holding steady at $150, which is 15 cents a gig, roughly, and 14 and something, but closing in on Ryan's ideal 10 cents per gigabyte.
Shroud's Law, yes.
Yeah, you know. And but it was interesting because you guys were posted on PC Per. You linked to an article on TechSpot where they have declared solid-state drives as being not only mainstream, but a commodity. And part of me feels like, well, duh. But it's interesting to look. Not a lot of surprises on this list. Samsung's 970 Evo Plus NVMe SSD is their best high-performance / enthusiast SSD. These are kind of their picks. It is kind of crazy because you look at that, and it says $85 on Amazon. But I assure you, a 2-terabyte 970 Evo Plus is not $85 on Amazon. And if it is, I'm buying 5 and reselling several of them on eBay next week. The 1-terabyte version of that is currently $247.99, which is probably $50 less than you could buy an NVMe 1-terabyte drive a couple, 3 weeks ago. So You know, we talked about it recently. The cost of SSDs has dropped a lot in the last 12 months, and memory has dropped a lot in the last 12 months. And by the way, you may have noticed GPU prices are much more reasonable. So it's a really fantastic time to be building a system, unless you're really curious about AMD's Ryzen 3000, which is going to be coming out later this year. Also, they picked Crucial's MX500. That was one of Alan's big favorites, testing over the years as their mainstream SSD. You know, if you don't have an SSD, just buy one and then, you know, email Twitch at twit.tv and let us know what you thought. Or, you know, tweet at Pappy Norton or at Sebastian Peake, because it will be a mind-blowing, awe-inspiring change in your life if you're still running a standard rotating drive. Western Digital Reds for their NAS drive or their best hard drive. Not a big surprise there. You know, it's they also give a shout-out to Seagate's Barracuda Pro. I don't think I've actually physically seen a Barracuda in excess of 5 years, except for one I pulled out of an old NAS. But, you know, it's if you need a lot of storage and you don't necessarily need a lot of speed, you can save yourself a staggering amount of money by going with a rotating hard drive. Anyhow, shout-out to TechSpots for picking a few drives and reminding us all that SSDs are incredibly affordable. Yes. I get excited.
We did it.
Everything's faster. Everything's so much faster. Oh, my goodness. We should take a moment to thank our sponsor on this week in computer hardware, ladies and gentlemen. Smart Deploy. Smart Deploy allows IT departments to re-image unlimited computer models from one golden image. They offer one-click user data migration for simplified migration, zero-touch network deployment, imaging over the internet, and application deployment to make your project stress-free. Stress-free projects. Doesn't that sound nice? Doesn't matter. 50 or 50,000 computers, they don't care how many systems you are imaging. They don't care how many systems you have to manage. Their patented device driver injection technology, combined with technician-built driver packages called platform packs, make your life easier. Their library of over 1,200 platform packs includes Lenovo, HP, Dell, and all other major OEMs. Doesn't matter if it's a new model or an old model, just download the pack and deploy your golden image to any business-class computer. Smart Deploy is the most reliable, easy-to-use solution that has been trusted to deploy over 2.2 million endpoints, the first and only solution to offer imaging over Wi-Fi. So you can now manage your remote users and satellite offices without being connected to the same network, which makes your life easier, especially if you have dozens of field offices. Deploy images, apps, and updated drivers to your endpoints via the cloud using Dropbox, Google Drive, OneDrive, or OneDrive for business cloud storage. Step-by-step wizards are going to guide you through the process. Complicated steps like sysprep handled for you automatically. You can have an answer file to automate tasks like domain join and computer naming for a hands-free, zero-touch deployment. No ramp-up, no training necessary. Migrate 100 computers to Windows 10 in under an hour with out-of-box multicast support. Are you drooling yet? Because I am. They got a Seattle-based support team made up of imaging Windows experts. They are just an email or phone call away. Companies like Nintendo, UCLA, and Nissan turn to Smart Deploy to make the dreaded task of computer imaging a bit less painful. And right now, Smart Deploy is giving our audience 15 free licenses with 1 year of support. That's $720 worth of free IT software at smartdeploy.com/twitch. If you work at a company with 50 to 50,000 computers, head to smartdeploy.com/TWICH to get 15 free licenses with 1 year of support. And we want to thank Smart Deploy for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Thank you. Oh, man. I like things that are automagical and that actually work. It's a good thing. I got a chance to play around with, actually, if you've enjoyed the new output, the upgrade from my previous webcam, that's thanks to two things. Sony A6000 with 35mm f1.8 lens, which is a nice camera and significantly better in the sensor department than the webcam I've been using for the last several thousand years. And an Elgato Camlink 4K, which I would yank up here, except if I yank it up here, I will probably damage the micro HDMI port on the camera, which would suck. Elgato, you may remember from TV devices and capture devices for our friends in the Mac universe. In the last few years, they've gotten really big on gaming. They have the Cam Link, several other PCI Express capture cards, a switching tool, and that works with open broadcasting software, and of course some very fancy lights that my partner in crime Shannon was reviewing on Tech Thing this week. But I got to give a shout out because Magewell, which is a company you've never heard of that sells on Amazon, does an HDMI USB capture device very similar to this, except it's silver. And that runs about $300. So for this to come out at $130 and do a very effective job is sweet. I have not done a lot of 4K testing with this. Most of my testing on this has been 1080p video at 30 or 60 frames per second, which it's done pretty flawlessly. But it does support up to 4K. I gotta say I've been really impressed because, A, it works. You do have to download and install their 4K capture software, which is a little... it kind of constantly records if you're not paying attention. So you have to get used to the sort of start and stopping of recording. It has an unusual workflow, I'll call it. Once you understand that workflow, it's pretty blunt simple. Until you understand that workflow, you may be like, if you're looking to capture video from a camera or video from a gaming system, that is not HTTP protected. I'm going to give a shout out and offer up some. Actually, you know, I'm really impressed with Elgato's Cam Link 4K. It's very small, and that's one of their key lights, which is currently incredibly impossible to find, which is not inexpensive because you can pick up lights from Neuwir, LED lights from Neuwir for like $65 a piece, maybe three for $150 with stands off of Amazon. And those single key lights that Elgato sell for about $200. But A, they have better LEDs, higher light output, and some really, really cool wireless control on those. And what a lot of people love, because of course they're marketing this towards Twitch streamers, is it comes with a stand that is designed to be mounted on the back of your desk. So you don't have to pull your desk 4 feet off the wall to fit soft boxes to get lighting on your Twitch streaming rig and lifestyle. Currently sold out, but if they are available, it's a pretty impressive piece of lighting for $200. And while that may sound incredibly expensive for a single light, and it is compared to the cheap stuff on Amazon, it is considerably less expensive than traditional lighting brands used by video professionals, where it's not unusual to spend $600 to $1,200 or $1,500 for a single LED light. But I got to say, it's a pretty slick system. And the Stream Deck is the box I was talking about, where it's essentially a programmable bundle of buttons. So if you don't want to customize a keypad you bought off of Amazon or eBay for $12, you can pick up Stream Deck and have a lot more buttons and have shiny programmable graphics behind each one of them. They're so shiny and so programmable. It makes you look elite. I don't know. I like it when things just work.
Yeah. And it's telling that stuff like that Elgato capture device and the lighting system have been harder to come by. Like, it's not unusual to see either of those out of stock. So apparently there are a lot of people still getting into game streaming.
I don't know if they're getting into, but certainly I've seen several reviews for people at before and after where they had massive. If you've never seen kind of a full on, lighting rig where there's big nylon, light diffusion, the light's this big, and then they put a giant nylon sort of box around it with a big opal panel on the front that diffuses the light. Yeah. They take up a lot of space, and they are also, they generate a metric fluff ton of heat.
Of heat, yeah.
To use a highly scientific term. So I got to say, the LEDs, I've been impressed with the LEDs from Neuwir. I think it's Neuwir. They have the strangest name. Their lights are actually shockingly good for the cost. Yeah, Neuwir, Neewer. They do ring lights, which a lot of YouTubers love, and then they also do more traditional light panels. You can buy optional batteries to power them off of battery. The frustrating thing about those is, for example, the 440 LED panels, it's 220 yellow lights and 220 white lights. So if you turn them all up, you get the sort of, I think it's like 2600 lumens or 2900 lumens if everything is turned up, but you get a really funky light temperature of 4200K, which is a little yellow, red, warm for most people shooting, because most people want like daylight, which is 5600K. The other big option that's a kind of a traditional Hollywood thing or television thing is, I want to say 2900 or 3200K, which is tungsten lighting. At some point, Burke's going to be like, no, that's not the right temperature, but around 3000K. But if you take these, you know, $65, $70 New Ear lights and you set them to 5600K, basically by turning all of the yellow LED lights or the yellow LED bulbs off, you go from 2900 lumens of output down to like 1400 lumens. And then you're like, I have to go buy a second light if you have a large room. So, you know, there's a reason inexpensive things are inexpensive. Not a big deal if your light is this far away on a desk. A bigger deal if you're working with a larger room that you want to illuminate fully for lighting purposes. In any case, it's probably more than enough lighting conversation for the show. And you have a pretty cool compact ATX case from Cooler Master that you dug deep in on this week.
Yes. This is the Masterbox Q500L. And what's interesting about this is it looks like a micro ATX enclosure, not even a very big one. And that's actually what I thought it was when this box arrived. But even though it's only 15 by about 9 by 15 inches, it is a full ATX case. So it's got the expansion slots in the back of a mid-tower ATX case, and it does hold a full ATX board with just a little bit of room to spare. And I was really impressed with it considering its size and its price. This is only a $60 case at full MSRP. So I put my full-size ATX board in there. I used one of Cooler Master's, you know, Hyper 212 coolers, the one that we reviewed a little while back, and a full-size graphics card and put it all together. It takes standard ATX power supplies, which interestingly sort of mount in the front of the case on this removable bracket. And the whole case actually is perforated. It's steel, and essentially there are just holes all over the frame, which give you flexibility with mounting like your power supply, which just you pick where you want it to be mounted, how you want it to be mounted. And it provides a generous amount of airflow, even though the power supply, if you're using a full-size one, is going to block a considerable amount of the front panel. You still have the top and the bottom of the case for ventilation. It has a large see-through side panel, which at first glance you might think is tempered glass, but is actually acrylic. And that goes to the cost again. This is a $59 MSRP. So that was totally fine. And another interesting idea is that they want you to be able to use this case vertically or horizontally. So the rear of the case, which is just held on with four thumb screws, the thumb screws themselves are rubberized. And you just turn the case over on its side and they become the feet. And the case I/O panel is also a separate unit. It just screws in and there are mounts for it on all four sides. So you can place it wherever you like. And that includes the power button, USB audio. So this is a little bit more modular than you might expect at first glance. Like you're thinking, okay, $59.99, holds an ATX board, but is very small. Airflow isn't as much of a concern because it's so ventilated. And then on top of that, you can place it kind of any way you want, and it becomes a really kind of compelling option, I think, for this price. So I was very pleased with the case overall, especially because even at this price, they are paying attention to things like screen filters. There's a screen filter on the bottom. The top nice. And front are magnetically attached screen filters. So they're easy to pull off and rinse off or vacuum off. So it's a very easy to live with case, and it was easier to build in than I thought. The only thing I had to do was take out the pre-installed 120mm exhaust fan to make room to actually like lower my ATX board down into it, because it was actually a little tricky to get it past the PSU mount without taking that fan out. But that was the only thing. Like, little things like that don't really affect the overall build process, and it's about as simple as it could possibly be. The case doesn't do any more than it has to, and is pretty sturdy too. Like, there's nothing wrong with steel. It's a little bit heavier than aluminum. There's a lot of steel in this case, but you the overall weight was lower than I expected because of that acrylic side panel too. So
interesting.
Unless you need a lot of storage, this is a great option.
Is there a handle?
There's no handle. We've definitely seen cases like that in the past. No Corsair had at least one, but no handle in this case. Although I'm sure with all of those holes, think about it. You could just bolt your own handle on the top of it.
I don't know. It's always nice to have a built-in handle on something that small. I was looking at Lenovo's, the Legion C530. Gosh, it was last year now that I think about it. And I was actually shocked if you are an esports kind of person or you still go to LAN parties, it's nice to have a handle built into the top of your case. Now we just need monitors that pack better. Oh, goodness. You were also, you finished like minutes before we started recording the podcast today. You finished up a fast review. And I'm going to point it out now. We normally don't do reviews of Kickstarter projects or GoFundMes. No, God, GoFundMes. Indiegogo projects because so often...
GoFundMe case project would be interesting. I could probably just come up with one of those myself.
I want a computer
Help me
case.
Buy a computer case. Yes. But you know what? The whole crowdfunded thing, if you look at this lineage, this I call it a cottage industry of small form factor enclosures on crowdfunding campaign sites. We had the N-Case M1, which I reviewed way back in 2014. Right. Dan Case A4 SFX, another brilliant shoebox style, all aluminum, ultra tiny mini ITX enclosure. And that was about 7.25 liters, I think. And very, very small. And so that's kind of been where you had to go to get the small form factor enclosures. Although I will say the Dan Cases has been picked up by, what is it, SSF Lab?
Yeah.
A small form factor web store. So that's something you can actually buy outside of a crowdfunding campaign. But this is another example, another crowdfunded. Someone came up with this design. They engineered it to be as small as you could possibly imagine for a full-size build. And this one is able to boast that they're under the 7-liter total volume. This one is like 6.9 liters.
Right. If you've never been to SFF Lab, by the way, you should go there because all the people involved in that seem to be really sterling human beings. I know Josh was sniffing because I've played around with a bunch of the Mini 4 cases he's built. Or I should say like the current one he's got out there is a SkyReach 4 Mini, which sadly is currently out of stock, not from Concentrate's S4 Mini. But he will have the next version of that. I think they are going to... next month, May 9th, 2019, going to do another batch of those. But I just want to give a shout out to the sfflab.com website because I've met a couple of those people. They seem really, really nice. And to amplify what you said, I've had several sort of headsets. I'm like 50-50 for seeing gaming headset, Kickstarter/Indiegogo projects deliver product. Are right, though. I don't think I've seen a case project that hasn't delivered. Tweet at Patrick Norton if you have been a part of a group-funded project that did not deliver its enclosure. But, the nice thing is, you got to build one of these. And I think we've noticed between the two of us and Ryan and Alan and anybody else who's been involved in Indiegogo or Kickstarter projects is if they have a finished project before they launch the crowdfunding, you're much more likely to actually get a finished project rather than a vague idea. With a promise to deliver eventually. I may be still a little bitter about the OSIC experience.
I detect a little bit of bitterness, perhaps. I mean, you're jaded.
If I had lost money,
crowdfunding campaign, I would be too.
For the most part, I had a really good average going in terms of crowdfunding and getting a product. And then they had 2 out of 3 products in the space of like 12, 15 months. Flat line on me. And that was one of those was a little bit more money than I really felt needed to be pissed away. You're guessing that you will eventually get a product and it will have all the features you asked for.
Speaking of physical products, if you're watching our video, I'll have
really
the camera
pretty.
Focus on this instead of my face. Yeah, it's really cool to me. It's about 13 by 12 by just under 3 inches. And I have a full system in here that I went completely out of my mind, of course, because this is the sickness of being in this business where you have all these components laying around. So I get a case like this and I'm thinking, okay, what's the most overspecced, outrageous build I could possibly put into this? So naturally, before I really thought about how I was going to cool the CPU, I installed a Core i9-9900K into this Z390 board and put the RTX 2080 Ti Founders Edition card in here and found a powerful enough SFX power supply to run these two together, but didn't really think too hard about air cooling. And I'll say the little Silverstone cooler that I had, it's from their Argon series. I believe this is the AR11. Did a remarkably good job of coping with the kind of outrageous thermals for a build this small from a Core i9 processor like this. So definitely don't use an i9-9900K when you're building with a case like this. But,
depends.
You know, I mean, even though that was kind of unnecessary, it still ran fine. Like, I was doing gaming tests with this last night before it was, like, 100% final. I hadn't written the whole review up yet, but I was getting load temps from this GPU of 79C. And 79 degrees is not bad at all for a 2080 Ti. And that was, like the high number for multiple runs in a game. And this case is ventilated well enough that a lot of hot air is expelled directly out the side.
Right.
It's one of those designs where you have perforations on one side of the case for the CPU and the power supply, and then the other side of the case for the GPU. And then the top and bottom of the case, if it's in a vertical orientation,
right,
also allow hot air to escape.
It's funny because I'm looking at a power draw chart for that 9900K, and it's a little frustrating in that that is rated as a 95 watt part, but if you load up all 16 cores on that, you're looking at something in the neighborhood of 150 to 160 watts total power consumption, which is tough for an enclosure that has such a small amount of Z on it, but not entirely unmanageable. I mean, you know, you're certainly not going to overclock that system and run all the cores. But I mean, when you were looking at the performance, were you getting, you know, when you have, you have, actually, I should say, did you get deep into sort of, you know, brutal benchmark testing where you were running all of the cores at 100%? And did they throttle down instantly, or did they actually keep a decent frames per second?
Some of the benchmarks measure out that way. But yeah, I was using the old venerable X.264 benchmark to load up all the cores. It always loads all the cores to 100% on its second pass.
Right.
And I let that run for 5 minutes straight. And the fan on this little cooler was going as fast as it could. It was topping out at like 3,100 RPMs.
Oh my goodness.
And definitely not quiet, because at that point you're talking about a 92 millimeter fan and it was putting out about 50-51 decibels at that point. But I wasn't seeing any thermal throttling even when I reached the 100 degree mark. And that's when I started to get a little nervous and wanted to shut the test down. But I let it go and it never got above that. It kind of hovered between 98 and 100 degrees. And I was expecting to see a lot of throttling, but I was at 100% utilization, and the speed was about 4.3 gigahertz at that point. So
that's really impressive.
Yeah. So the cooler ended up being kind of an interesting side story. One of the other things about this case, though, which is fascinating to me that I haven't really got a chance to get into, is you can eliminate the graphics card, and that other half of the enclosure becomes room for like 3.5-inch hard drives.
Oh, wow.
Or you can do something really interesting, and I need to find a GPU of 175 millimeters or shorter. And at that point, there is technically space and mounting for a 120 millimeter all-in-one cooler, as long as it's slim enough. Or you, like, I know Silverstone has slim all-in-one coolers, and they also sell slim fans for them. You can do kind of your own combination of like standard cooler, slim fan, or slim cooler, or whatever. And as long as it has flexible enough tubing, they showed examples of this working with like a standard Corsair all-in-one cooler and having just enough room to route everything. So that makes it a lot more interesting, because then you could make this into a workstation that maybe is doing more of a CPU load. You could actually use a processor like this, or even a Xeon. If you got one of those mini ITX Xeon workstation boards, you could make this into a home theater server and use a much more power efficient CPU and just load it up on storage. You could put four different spinning hard drives in this between 3.5 and 2.5 inch sizes. And then of course there's M.2 storage on the board as well. You could explore. It's just a fun platform as far as in my experience anyway, with a lot of different flexibility, different options. It comes with this really nice stand that matches it, lets you put it up vertically, which they recommend for really high airflow, like high performance gaming workstation builds like the one that I did. But again, it's a crowdfunded project. It's not something you can just go to Newegg or Amazon and buy today. So you would have to back it. It's fully funded at this point. It's just a matter of them delivering. But we're talking about a campaign that's about a week and a half old. It's already reached its goal. So this is the second generation of their Sentry cases. So the first one was massively overfunded, was delivered. And this is just like the refined version 2.0.
Nice. I like it. It's a good looking case. It is a good looking case. You may be familiar with two-factor authentication keys. Yubico has certainly been carrying the flag on that for quite some time. I know people who are alarmingly serious about security because they pen test. They like the sort of the Yubico plus the FIDO standard. The crew over at Google made big waves when they released their Titan key. They basically claim as long as people are using their 2FA, they have had zero successful employee phishing attacks inside of Google's infrastructure, which is a really big deal because targeted phishing attacks are alarmingly successful and used extensively when people are trying to hack their way into a corporate network. Interesting announcement, if you have Android 7 or higher, you can actually now use your phone as a Google security key for two-factor authentication. So this is a pretty big piece of news. Brian Krebs is an amazing security reporter, did a very, very large write-up on it. But essentially, you have to be, if you are enrolled in two-factor authentication and for your Google environment, I should say 2SV, as they call it, two-step verification on your Google account, you can use your phone, set up your phone to be used as a security key. So I just want to give a shout out to that. You will need a Chrome OS, Mac OS 10, or Windows 10 computer with a Chrome browser that supports Bluetooth to set up your phone as a security key. But I just want to give a shout out to Google on that one, because it's a nice addition to the operating system and to the devices for people who are security conscious. I also want to give a shout out to the Google blog where they remind you to create a backup security key to your account and keep it someplace safe in case you lose your primary key. That can be really awkward. Don't ask me how I know. But, you know, Titan's really cool. YubiKey, the YubiKeys from Yubico are outstanding, and now, yay, you can use your Android device too. So if you are looking for better security, that is something to consider. If you're looking to feel really creeped out and you have in your home, I'm just going to read this title from Bloomberg. Amazon workers are listening to what you tell Alexa. A global team reviews audio clips in an effort to help the voice-activated assistant respond to commands. We've seen a lot of peculiar stuff in the world of voice control, and my personal favorite being someone in the EU asking for copies of all of their data that had been recorded and then being sent the data for another person, i.e. not their data. But literally, you know, there are thousands of people who work for Amazon listening to what's going on with Alexa to make Echo better. This probably, you know, should not be a shock. But as Bloomberg points out, Amazon likes to say that Alexa, quote, lives in the cloud and is always getting smarter. But, you know, people are in there, contractors, full-time employees. Boston, Costa Rica, India, and Romania are cited in the Bloomberg report on places where they are located. But it's kind of crazy. Imagine a nine-hour shift with the reviewer from Amazon parsing, quote, as many as 1,000 audio clips per shift. And, you know, it's a lot of it's really subtle stuff, you know. Case in point, Bloomberg article, talked to a worker in Boston, and, you know, they listened over and over to how different people say Taylor Swift and made sure that the algorithm understood, or I should say Alexa understood, that somebody was asking for Taylor Swift, the artist. And it's kind of crazy to remember, because we talked a lot about this sort of battle between Google and Amazon, and to a lesser degree Microsoft and our friends over at Apple, to make voice control better. And part of the reason why so much of this stuff is offered free is because the more people talk to these devices, the more opportunities they have to improve the systems to make them vastly more functional. But there's still a human element, and it's probably anonymized and it's probably difficult to trace, but just remember, someone is listening. Maybe not in a really meaningful or scary way. You know, and Amazon was like very, very clear. Quote, we only annotate an extremely small sample of voice recordings in order to improve the customer experience. For example, this information helps us train our speech recognition and natural language understanding system so it can better understand your request and ensure the service works well for everyone. And of course, noting that they take security and privacy strictly, and that they have strict technical and operational safeguards. Quote, and a zero tolerance policy for the abuse of our system. Employees do not have direct access to information that can identify the person or the account as part of this workflow. All information is treated with high confidentiality, and we use multi-factor authentication to restrict access, service encryption, and audits of our control environment to protect it. So, you know, there are people listening. Amazon doesn't make that clear. Big shock. It's probably pretty mundane, but it's been interesting to watch this sort of commentary evolving around this on the interwebs. So people are listening in my garage, not in my house, because my wife won't let me bring this stuff in the house from the garage. But my garage, all the voice control is in there, and it's listening. Apparently more closely than I thought.
Listening to all the frustration and possibly profanity during
it is the garage of hope and coffee. Not the garage of frustration, rage, and suffering. Except when it is. Yeah. Have you seen the first photo of a black hole ever?
Somehow I've missed this, Patrick, because apparently I hate science, according to you. So please tell me.
You know? So you can get snarky, but I can't mock. Is that the way this rolls now? Come on, pull the picture up, Kevin.
I can show him.
Go ahead. Show him the picture. Yes. This is crazy. That spot in the middle is a black hole. The orange is apparently gases that have collected around the black hole. The ring from Science News, say a bright disk of gas orbiting the supermassive behemoth in the galaxy M87, and the spot is the black hole's shadow. You know, this is as close to Plato's cave as I think I'm going to get in my adult life. But they used, it's a crazy network of telescopes, the Event Horizon Telescope, and looked deep into galaxy M87 to create this, quote, first ever picture of a black hole. You may note that black holes, of course, suck in all of the light and all of the things, and therefore are kind of difficult to photograph because no light. But I just think I've been reading about this and geeking out over this and being alarmingly fascinated by this to the point where I think my kids are almost ready to tell me to stop showing them this picture. So if you want to nerd out and get your astrophysics on, just do a search. First picture of a black hole, or head over to Science News. They have a ton of explainers on this. An MIT graduate student was involved in kind of setting up the experiment to get the picture. I just get all excited about that. That's all I'm going to say. So Oh, my goodness. I have something I am reviewing that we will talk about next week that I cannot talk about yet for fear that shark attack lawyer or attack sharky lawyer or lawyer shark attacky thingies will drop from the ceiling brandishing Lord knows what kind of legal documentation to make my life misery and hell. So is there anything you, sir, can talk about that's coming up on the PC Per?
No. I'm trying to think, like, what? Because when you do a lot of meetings, and it's like, wait a minute, what was under embargo and what wasn't? So the safe answer is no, I cannot divulge anything. There'll be some
you
more component
everything
reviews.
Is under embargo. You get sued.
Yeah, us. just presume I can't actually tell you anything.
Well, do yourself a favor, ladies and gentlemen. Head over to pcper.com and see more of Mr. Sebastian Peake's work in hardware testing. And if you're thinking about buying a GPU or a CPU or building a PC, check out the leaderboard, which has recently been updated to take advantage of all the new GPUs. And if it hasn't, I'm sure Sebastian is going to leap over there immediately and make the updates. Actually, he has updated it. I know because I've been there because I was looking at a build last week. My name is Patrick Norton. You can find me when I'm not on Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, the podcast or video you are listening to or watching right now. You can head on over to TechThing, TechThing.com or AVXL.com, where we talk about, well, all kinds of technology and your questions and home theater and audio gear. I have some subwoofer reviews coming up and some headphone reviews that'll be up on the next show. And there should be a new episode of AVXL up there right now. If not, we will fix this post haste. If this is your first episode of Twitch, do yourself a favor. Head over to twit.tv/Twitch. You get all of the links to all of the ways to subscribe, to watch the audio or listen to the video. Scratch that, reverse that, and you can listen or watch as you prefer, where you prefer, and all the information on that is at twit.tv/Twitch. I want to thank you for listening or watching. Whichever you prefer to do is okay with us. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Sebastian Peake.
Catch you next week on Twitch.